Good evening. Hello. To echo David, welcome Winter Solstice. Thank you for the poem, especially. I was sharing with somebody downstairs, and probably due to various factors, one we determined might be the warmth we've had, is that I don't feel the dark as much this year as I have in previous years. It's like we're already going back towards the light. And so that poem was a good reminder of, well, for me, a lot of people, like, we celebrate, the light's returning, but we can also, and again, via the poem, cherish the less and less time we have with the dark. Cherish the dark. Hold it and be held by it and enjoy what we can of it, because it's getting less and less right now. At least for us northern hemispherians. So I appreciate that. And I also appreciate it because that's about as solstice-y as our talk will get tonight. in past years, I think I've been at Springs Mountain Sangha right around the solstice and kind of felt inspired to give a talk about the dark and the light just because that's what was happening. And this year, that inspiration wasn't there, and it's partly because I haven't been feeling the poignancy of the solstice. So I have other things on my mind, enlightening or in darkening, whatever they may be. Tonight, I've been realizing, like, the last few talks I've given kind of turned into a series in a way, building on one another, connecting to one another. But then all talks can kind of do that in a way. Sometimes all talks are just the same talk with different words, right? But this one, this time it feels like, well, this being the third of these last talks, are kind of connected. So if you didn't hear, well, you might not have heard the one up in Colorado Springs. And you might not have been here last month for the talk I gave here. So this is partly a shameless plug to go visit my website if you want to hear them. But the first talk that I gave here about a month ago was about uncertainty. And, you know, when we're thrust into the uncertainty of life, what to do about that? If anything, the highlight being, it's always uncertainty. Life is like that. We get this delusion that it isn't that way. And then we have these moments that can break it open and show you, ha-ha, everything is unknown and uncertain, right? So that was the first of this unknown series, the birth of it. And then the talk I gave up in the Springs shortly after that had to do with really, in a way, shoring up our energy, doing what we can with our energy for the long haul. Moving from a place of reactivity to responsiveness. And kind of when we're thrust into uncertain times or the unexpected, there can be a lot of reactivity that takes up a lot of our energy, and we're battling it, or, you know, a lot of our energy goes there. And then once we get over that initial phase, there's a long stretch of things to come, and if we waste all of our energy there, we might not have enough for the long haul. So that was the second talk, was about how to allow the, like a pressure cooker, let the pressure energy shoot out, but not waste our energy and be able to hold it so we can have energy for moving forward. In between which, I did this kind of movement here, like up here is reactivity of the initial event, then we loop down here, and then we get to the long haul, but there's a very big temptation to stay in this loop. When the energy is released and it's like, okay, I don't have to face anything, crisis averted or whatever. And there's a real danger in becoming apathetic if we stay there. So that talk was about keeping your head lit on fire to keep going. So you can check that out too. So tonight, and these come linearly, but like a lot of things, they're not necessarily in that order. It's kind of a glob. You can glob all these together at any given time and see how they inform one another. But tonight I'm interested in the truth. And how we can't know it. But we think we can. And that's where we base a lot of our reactions and responses from. Even if it's being responsive, we're basing it off of a truth that we feel we are in touch with, which we cannot possibly be in touch with. So that's kind of cool. To notice that, go, oh, well, then what do we do? Yeah. You know, right now, this whole thing of the fake news that we've been hearing, these fake news sites putting out these fake stories, that's the fake news, right? And we got duped by the fake news. But then you have, well, the mainstream media is biased, so it's not right either. So that's just as fake as the fake news. All this kind of stuff happening, right? And it was, you know, this came up for me more directly when, you know, I was reading about a situation in the world and feeling my heart tugged by it, broken by it, and then having somebody else say, well, that's just the presentation of the mainstream or the fake or whatever, and they're not telling you the other side of the story. Maybe that's not even true, what you're reading. That's all manipulation. And it's like, well, that's possible. And there's a part of me that was like, well, then what do I do? You know, what can I rely upon to give me the accurate happening so then I can maybe affect things more directly and act? But it can kind of lead me to feel like I can't do anything because I can't trust anything, right? But I know I can't stay in a place of not doing anything because I can't trust it, or not doing anything because understanding that what I'm doing is based off of a lack of true information. I have to act. I have to do something. I must do something. Yeah. So the refrain from our precept study has been keeping me company as looking into this. The one from Bodhidharma where he says, the way things are is mysterious and hard to see. At any given moment, the way things are is mysterious and hard to see. Let that be that common denominator for me of these times. To know that as I am experiencing things, it's mysterious and it's hard to see the things I'm experiencing. But to know that it's mysterious and hard to see allows me some breathing room. Allows me to ease into, it's all right that I'm not going to have, well, I was going to say 100%, but I'm not going to have 80% of what's reality. At any given time, the way things are always mysterious and hard to see. Maybe we'd say mysterious and impossible to see. Yet we're always trying to find the truth. Maybe not always, but it seems to be a constant endeavor. What's the truth? What's the reality of this situation? Whether it be a small one in my life or a larger one in the world, so that I can act and be of benefit, right? So that word truth comes up for us in the koan tradition. The word koan, there's a Zenkei Shibayama, a Japanese teacher, who offers that etymologically, the word koan means the place where the truth is found. And that's really interesting. I'm smiling. And for those of you who have worked with koans, either in groups or individually or both, you're probably familiar with koans aren't a static, still thing where you go, I found it! And you put down the stake you claim and, Eureka, I found the truth! So to hear etymologically, it means the place where the truth is found. But to know that it's a dynamic, moving thing, a koan practice. It's not about landing someplace. So that brings in the place where the truth is found in this moment, and this moment, and this moment. Constantly finding the truth, but never staking the claim and waving the flag that this is it. But then we also have to understand the way things are is mysterious and hard to see. So that truth that we're constantly finding isn't really the truth in that moment. And fortunately, there's a next moment to erase it, and we can see what is the next truth that's coming our way. Yeah? So it's really about a practice of being grounded in the groundless. This practice. Which, you know, somebody said, what do you depend and rely upon? And I was to say, nothing at all. That could be kind of, well, that's not very helpful. But I find it helpful to know that there's nothing at all to rely or depend upon, thankfully. So with all that, you know, that groundwork or that common denominator behind the scenes stuff there, I'm looking at the situation in our world today, and people in their own camps who, you know, this camp is saying this is how it is, and this camp is saying no, this is how it is, and there's kind of this battle going on, who's right, who's wrong, and even within the camps, people might, well, it's like that, but also, you know, there's no kind of common agreement that, yes, this is how it is across the board. You have the two sides or the four sides or the 84,000 sides. The Buddhist term that means countless. But that's what we're basing our arguments on and our actions upon, is how we think it is, each of us in our own camp, in our own world. And we really shift our energy in trying to decide which of our delusions is the right one. Is that camp's delusion? We don't realize it's a delusion, maybe. Well, we say that, oh no, we no, theirs is a delusion, we know that. Well, you don't realize that ours is equally a delusion by the fundamental matter that we cannot know how things are. So instead we're battling which delusion or illusion is the right one. And we're kind of neglecting the truth, the larger thing, maybe, that we could be directing our energy toward. Instead, we're battling over the delusions, right? So I'd suggest, you know, a way to shift that battle is to try to keep in mind the larger field of what we're trying to do, what we're trying to see and understand, and accept that I, individually, cannot know completely what it is. And I need all the other delusions, all the other perspectives to help me get a better idea of what it is. What came to mind when I was first encountering this with the fake news and you can't really know how it is, was this supposedly, and I'll believe it. It was on Google, so I'll believe it. The most popular Zen garden, the rock gardens in Japan, is one at Ryonji, which means dragon or sleep temple of the peaceful dragon. So it's a very famous rock garden that you've probably seen images if you've ever looked up Zen rock gardens. You've seen images of it more than likely. And it's a very simple rectangular garden. And with those, they have a fence around it here, and then there's a platform, a viewing platform, that stretches the length of the garden. And in this one, there are 15 stones that make up the different areas of the garden. And they're not all separate. They're connected, like three stones here, five stones, you know. They're put together in a certain way. But people realized, looking around at this garden, that it's impossible to see all 15 stones at once from any one place on the viewing platform. And they don't, they never asked, never got the answer of why did he design it that way, that you can't see the 15 stones from one perspective. And for me, it's like, well, so I could give this talk. Because it's great. It's like, oh, that's how life is. From my perspective, I can only see so much of the garden. And I can't see the 15th stone. Maybe I'm only seeing 12 or 13 from my perspective, because this one's hidden behind there, and all that other, all the other possibilities. So I'll get this image in my mind, but then I'll run over here and I'll get it here. Now I can see the other stones, but not the ones I saw before, but I know they're there, but I don't know what they look like from this perspective because I can't see, you know, all that kind of thing. So I can shift my own views around, but I'm still not going to see the whole thing. So I can get a group of people together. We can all occupy different places on the platform. And among the group of us, we can see all 15 stones. And it feels like we have a more complete picture. And so we depend upon one another to get a more full idea of the garden. But then you have to realize we're only seeing one side. There's the fences. Nobody's at the fence looking in, right? So even if we have a pretty full perspective and can see all 15 stones, we don't have all the sides of the stones represented. But it's better. It's a little, it's a fuller picture. But being cagey and whatever, it's like, well, what if we do the aerial thing? What if we get up above? Now we can see all 15 stones, and I could even do it by myself. But then I'm only seeing from the top. I don't see it from the other way. And then I don't know of anybody who's going to be willing to go dig under the ground and look at them, you know, right on their face. So no matter what we attempt, we will never be able to fully see the garden. And that's okay. That's what we have. It's not about seeing the entirety of the garden, which is impossible. It's about getting as full of perspective, as full of a view as we can. And it takes more than one. We need to allow the other perspectives in, even if they disagree with mine. Even though they disagree, they help bring the fullness of the garden, of the picture in. And you could, you know, well, how could you really disagree about a stone, right? But I think about Charlie Brown and the kite-eating tree. Do you know this, some of you? You know, he flies his kite, and then the tree catches it and eats it up. I never had that happen to me. But if Charlie Brown and I were walking and we saw a tree, he would have a whole lot of ideas about what that tree is that I wouldn't have, because he has a different perspective on what trees are. So the same thing could happen with a simple stone. So we don't get a complete picture even when we're all there. And the information that comes from each of the individuals is biased in some way. But that's what we've got, right? And it's good to acknowledge we cannot see the entirety of it. So the other analogy that comes up around this has a little bit more of a lively dynamic to it, which I appreciate because life is lively. Yeah, it has to do with the old story of the blind man and the elephant. Each of them getting a hold of a part of it. Oh, this is a rope. No, this is a tree. No, it's a snake. All this kind of stuff. Then they talk to one another and they go, oh, it's an elephant. We put all the pieces together, right? That sounds like a more whole picture, right? Maybe even more so than the garden. But I think we're all still wrong. When we put our perspectives together and say, it's an elephant, we're wrong if we think we know what it is to be an elephant. If we know the elephant because we can identify it as an elephant. So what occurred to me was, if I really want to know the elephant, I need to get up on top and ride it. You know, if I'm grabbing the tail or grabbing the leg, I'm knowing a part of it, and it's not necessarily moving. It might move a little bit. But if I'm on top of the elephant, it's moving, and I'm feeling the life of the elephant. And I know a little bit more about the elephant. But I still don't know all. Because there's the inner experience of the elephant. It's like when it's hungry versus when its belly is full, how does it walk differently? I might be able to feel that, but I don't know the elephant's inner experience. But it feels better to be riding upon it and more in touch, in tune with its life, than to be pointing at it and saying, oh, it's an elephant, and I think I know what that is. I even recall seeing elephants pick up food off the ground with sand and grit on it, and they put it in their mouth. And I'm wondering, does that bother them? You know, for me, it would bother me because I'm a human. I don't have a trunk, but I have had sand in my food. But for an elephant, it might just be, yeah, that's fine. Maybe they like it. I don't know. And that's something I can never know about the elephant. Yeah? So the elephant of life, there's a part of life that I can never know about. And we're all blind people with life. And our blindness our blindnesses are our individual perspectives and our biases. Our life experiences blind us to knowing the totality of life. And that's okay. We all come with something, yeah? So rather than trying to pin it down and know what it is, we can ride along with it, be as close to it as we can, come fully with our perspectives and our biases, our blindness. Join in the blindness of others and converse and know things together that way, and still know that none of us, with all of our efforts, are going to know what it's like to eat gritty food as an elephant does, as life does, yeah. So we get close to knowing the truth, really close and intimate, but we never know it completely. And there's something important about acknowledging that and kind of leaning into that and resting into that when we're trying to deal with our lives individually, collectively, to lean into we can't ever really know how it is completely, and we must act from that place. Collectively, depending upon one another, yeah. So I want to bring one last bit in, and this has a kind of a twofold quality to it, and this is one of the fundamental teachings of Buddhism from the Yogacharya school, and so don't let that put you off. Or let it put you off. It's okay. It has to do with the inner workings of things, which I'll talk about in a moment. But the other side of it is that it's kind of what I've been talking about already from a different perspective, from the external interaction of things. And so, even though it's, you might put it in Buddhist philosophy category, and you're welcome to just go, oh, I don't want to hear about it, and tune it out if you've got something good already. But what it highlights for me is that whatever we're looking at in our lives, our social situation, looking into our individual situation, whatever we're seeing is the fundamental aspect of reality all the time. So even though this is a Yogacharya teaching, I've been talking about it already, and it's manifesting in our lives all the time. So it's not about going someplace else to philosophize and look into deep matters. You're doing it all the time. That's a good thing. So don't trivialize your own experiences. Don't think, oh, I'm just dealing with my own emotional, this isn't that. You're always face to face with the fundamental reality of things. Yeah. It calls to mind another truth statement. Zen truth statement thingy from Dogen, where he says, if you don't find the truth right where you stand, where do you expect to find it? So again, don't think you have to go off someplace else to look into the deep matters of life. They're right here all the time. So, the inner workings of staring at the stones or looking at and grabbing on or riding the elephant have to, in the inner workings per the Yogacharya school, have to do with the 8 levels of consciousness that Buddhism describes. The first 5 are our senses. So, each of those is considered a consciousness. Sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. Then, after that, we have a 6th consciousness, which sees all those interacting together and forming a network and decides there's something cohesive here. These aren't separate things. They're connecting and becoming one whole thing. They form this net. So a consciousness that decides there's a unity here, or there's a network here, yeah? Then there's the 7th consciousness, which personalizes it. It's sometimes called the emotional consciousness. It's where we identify not only a unity, but a self. And that's our biases and all of that coming in. Then there's the 8th level, which is the alaya vijnana, called the storehouse or repository consciousness. And in there lie the seeds of everything. Sometimes it's called karmic consciousness. The things that informs our biases and the way that we experience things through our senses and how we perceive the network are in this storehouse. They're kind of like the seeds, again, of everything. So resting in that storehouse consciousness, we have an understanding of, oh, this is how it's working. It's not necessarily getting caught up in the personal of the 7th consciousness, but understanding how the personal developed and how things are the way they are and why we see them the way that we see them. So in the other thing, it's that noticing, well, you see it that way because you're on that side of the garden, I see it this way because I'm on this side, and that makes sense. We see why it is that way. But then there's an interesting thing that can happen in the 8th level of consciousness, is that there's a possibility to transform it. Whereas what I've been describing, we see how things as they are come about, the suchness of things happen. But then there's experience, and this is at the heart of Zen, when, to use a Zen phrase, body and mind drop away, or the great death. We drop in, and we are the suchness of things. And even to say that doesn't speak to it. You can't talk about it. But instead of just understanding how it works, it's being fully the working of it all. Being suchness itself. Yeah. And when that happens, the transformation happens in that realm of the 8th consciousness. And it doesn't stop anything else from happening. All the other 7 still exist, except they're no longer confined and anchored to our ideas about them and the identities we've assigned to them. So there's a freedom that happens, but it's still your life happening just as it does. There's just this underlying sense of they've been freed from this idea of how it is to just being what they are, no longer anchored or tethered or confined. So that's that. Sometimes we have these Zen phrases of you listen with your eyes and see with your toes. That's from the perspective, if you can talk about it that way, of the transformation of that storehouse consciousness. So again, it doesn't mean your life goes away, it just means its coming forth is more free, less bound, right? So to loop this back into what I was speaking of earlier and, you know, back into our life, which we haven't left really, to have that transformation for me is, in our current situation, instead of having our energy invested in the battle of the delusions, we shift our allegiance to the way of things. And how do we address the way of things? And we invite the delusions. It's no longer a battle, it's a conglomerate of delusion. And our energy and our motivation, our intention is more towards figuring out how do we respond? What do we do and we accept the help that we can get from anywhere, our own delusions or those that others offer us. Yeah. So I think that's a transformation we're all invited to embody. At this time in particular, it seems very poignant, but as I've been saying through these last several talks, it's always like this. Things are always uncertain. There's always a chance to be reactive and then deal with the immediate and then not have energy for the long haul. And there's always the possibility to get caught up with our stories and to battle over that and forget the larger picture and the long arc of the life that we are a part of and that we're contributing to and helping go forward. Yeah. And we have, thankfully, moments where these things are shoved into our faces and become more alive for all of us. Whether it's personally us going through turmoil or us sitting here going, what the fuck's wrong with all them? You know, everything's fine. Why are they acting that way? That's thrust into our face too, right? So it's not about if you're feeling reactive, then you're in this place and others aren't. It's wherever you are, thankfully you have the other perspective of calamity or calmness filling out the picture. So I'm grateful for times where the rug gets pulled out and everything gets discombobulated. The last time I felt this way in a large way was 9/11. Mm-hmm. And I think had I been a teacher at that time, I might be giving a similar talk because, you know, we were on this course of following our certainties, and we just knew how things were, and all of a sudden the whole world got flipped upside down and scattered, and there was great opportunity, actually, because we were able to see the veils lifted somewhat and a little more reality of what makes up this world and this life and the network of our perspectives that can help us move forward. And we have an opportunity, had one then and have one now, to either try to put things back together and build our camps up and get back to what we should be doing, or not to. To keep it open. To allow the conversations and the perspectives to mix and mingle, not confine the world, but go more deeply and fully into it. So, what do you choose? Each moment, notice, what do you choose? What do you welcome? What do you push away? That's part of it too. It's interesting that I gave an introduction one time, introduction to our practice, and called it being with what is. And that comes up again and again. This practice is about being with what is. We have to understand we have no idea what is. And that's what we get to be with. So as long as we give up the idea that we will actually ever know what is, what is, then we have something to lean into and carry us along. Because our energy isn't focused and tied up and trying to land somewhere. It's got that fuel for the long haul of the journey. What is here? What is here? Again and again and again popping up. Mysterious and hard to see. One time I found myself saying, the way things are is mysterious and easy to see. Knowing that what I'm seeing is all delusion, but I can see it quite clearly. And to acknowledge, well, it's easy. This reality that I am experiencing is the reality I have. I should go with that as my companion and my entrance into responding and doing and being in the world. Yeah. So, thank you.